Having been in Japan for a couple of weeks, I was becoming accustomed to not understanding anything that was going on. When I was younger, I had traveled a bit through Europe, which is certainly foreign, but not nearly as foreign as Japan. Having taken a soupçon of French in high school, I could sort of make my way around, slowly deciphering signs and figuring out rudimentary directions. I did manage to get my wife into the emergency room in Spain without being able to say much more than mañana and taco. My wife, otherwise known as G, and I took our honeymoon in the beautiful beach communities of Costa del Sol, the Spanish shore of the Mediterranean. It was kind of dumb going there, as it entailed traveling for over a day to get to an environment that was almost exactly like the one we left in L.A. A hot, deserty, scrubby place near the ocean where everybody spoke Spanish. I didn't know Spanish, but G took a couple of years of it in high school, so I was relying on her to get us around. She was a seasoned traveler, had spent a year in England, so I thought I was in good hands. Good hands, yes. Good tongue, not so much. Little did either of us know that she'd go completely mute when actually faced with a native Spanish speaker. So I'd leap in with my best Franish and get those hands waving and we'd be able to get from point A to point B. Several times, I'd be proud of myself for figuring out how to ask a particular question, what time is the train to Madrid, only to be met with an incomprehensible answer. Or, like the time I successfully ordered dinner in Spanish, thoroughly pleased with my sophistication. The waitress came back and said, "Be careful, the plate is extremely hot," which came out like, "blah blah blah plato, blah 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 caliente," and I grinned widely, said, "gracias," and grabbed the plate from her, nearly scorching off my fingerprints, and dropped it on the table, while the alarmed waitress reeled off another few blah-blahs, which properly translated meant something like, "What the hell is the matter with you, moron? I told you it was too hot." There's a wonderful story I heard years ago about a guy who had traveled to Turkey. He knew a little bit of the language, but was always struggling to learn more. One night, he was out on a hill and noticed a beautiful full moon. He pointed up to it and asked somebody there what the word for that was. She replied, "Parmak." "Okay, moon is parmak." He filed it away. Later that night, the overhead light in his hotel room burned out. He went down to the desk to see if he could get another bulb, but he didn't know how to say light bulb in Turkish. Traveling through foreign countries, you become adept at employing every trick you can think of to communicate, and the locals will often be quite obliging if they can see you're making an effort. So, he decided to employ a little poetic license, and, pointing his finger to the ceiling, asked the clerk if he had an electric parmak, pleased with his metaphor. The clerk looked at him nervously. He repeated his request, thrusting his finger up helpfully. The clerk looked more and more alarmed while he kept pointing up and requesting an electric parmak. Only later did he learn that Parmak actually means finger, not moon.
Istanbul was Constantinople, now it's Istanbul, not Constantinople. Been a long time gone, Constantinople, now it's Turkish delight on a moonlit night. Every gal in Constantinople lives in Istanbul, not Constantinople. So if you've a date in Constantinople, she'll be waiting in Istanbul. Even old New York was once New Amsterdam. Why they changed it, I can't say.
People just liked it better that way.
So take me back to Constantinople. No, you can't go back to Constantinople. Been a long time gone, Constantinople. Why did Constantinople get the works? That's nobody's business but the Turks. Istanbul.
So, anyway, traveling through Europe can be a challenge with only a dim recollection of rudimentary French classes, but it is doable. The signs can be deciphered, you can read a menu, more or less, you can figure out the bathrooms, and if you wear dark clothes and keep your mouth shut, you can almost pass as a native, or at least blend pretty well into the crowd. Just stay the hell away from the other Americans and you'll be fine. That's not an option in Japan. Japan's more like being on another planet than being in another country. There isn't anything you can wear that will disguise the fact that you're bright white and a foot taller than everybody else. Even Japanese dogs looked at me funny. And forget trying to piece together enough of the language to get around. If you're lucky, some of the signs might be in Romanji, or Roman letters, instead of kanji, the stylized pictograms of traditional Japanese writing. But even that doesn't help much. There's so little to hang on to, and navigating your way around the city and accomplishing such relatively minor tasks as ordering lunch or getting on the right train can be enormously exhausting and trying experiences. Plus, not only are the languages different, the cultures are almost entirely unrelated. There's all sorts of things in Japan, vending machines that dispense hot cheeseburgers or used underwear, pachinko, hostess bars, that have no real analog in America. Some prices are entirely reasonable. If you're careful, you can eat a good meal for under $10, and you can spend all evening soaking, scrubbing, and relaxing in the local sento for about $3. And others are completely outrageous. We paid $75 to drive for a couple of hours on a toll road, and buying a single melon can set you back well over $100. You drink differently, eat differently, sleep differently, and go to the bathroom differently. You can drunkenly piss on the side of a temple, but don't blow your nose in public. And why snack on chips and a Coke when you can munch on a bowl of sweetened dried clams and wash it down with some refreshing Pocari Sweat? I had gone there as a fabulous 30th birthday present, best present ever, organized surreptitiously by my wife to visit my friend Bob. Bob and I were close in high school at Interlaken, and I stayed in touch with him over the years. He had actually invited me to move out to Japan with him upon my graduating from Hampshire College. He was just finishing up a stint at Oberlin, but it was much too scary a proposition for me. However, I was delighted to go visit him for a couple of weeks. All in all, it was a spectacular trip, and because he lived off the beaten track in Kyoto, I got to experience Japanese life like few tourists do, eating in small, out-of-the-way places, going to markets and the local sento, which quickly became my favorite activity. It was a wondrous experience, but it was completely exhausting. I was always slightly off balance by everything, struggling to make sense of so much stimulus at once. And it isn't just that the language and the culture are completely different, which is taxing enough. Everything is different. The houses are different. The cars are different. The shoes are different. The automatic doors are different. The cats are different. The food, the television, the movie, the stores, everything. So, when I traveled with Bob to visit his girlfriend's apartment just outside Osaka and met her younger sister, and she confessed a rabid fanaticism for Beck, well, I didn't blink an eye. Sure, why not? You eat dead fish eyes for breakfast and watch sumo wrestling. Why not have a thing for Beck? It was only on the plane on the way home that it struck me how strange that was. It has long been recognized that Japanese schoolgirls are on the absolute bleeding edge of cool. Wired magazine has a regular Japanese schoolgirl watch column dedicated to spotting new trends. Tomoko, Bob's girlfriend's sister, not long out of short plaid skirts herself, was apparently still plugged into the zeitgeist, because although he was but a small blip on the cultural radar, seemingly destined to be a future Trivial Pursuit question, Beck was just about to take over the world, as improbable as it seemed, and, frankly, still seems.
I was born in this hotel, washing dishes in the sink.
Like those lucky cavern dwellers who caught the Beatles when they were still Liverpudlians, or those 12 people that wandered in off the street to hear the Ramones blitzed through their first sets at CBGB's, I can lay some small claim to being there when something big happened. I saw Beck open for the Tough Skins, a short-lived country big band featuring several friends of mine, at the long-defunct legendary L.A. dive, Raji's. There were fewer than a dozen people in the audience. The Tough Skins outnumbered their fans at this point. Well, at any point, really. And nobody gave a crap about this scraggly slacker pretending he was the illegitimate offspring of Woody Guthrie and Bob Dylan. Of course, nobody had any idea what was about to happen, least of all Beck himself. About this time, 1993, Beck Hansen, for the record, sat down in the kitchen of his friend Carl Stevenson, who later became Forest for the Trees, and recorded a song called Loser.
In the time of chimpanzees, I was a monkey. Butane in my veins and mouth to cut the chuggy with the plastic eyeballs. Spray paint the vegetables, dog food skulls with the beefcake pantyhose. Kill the headlights and put it in neutral. Stock car flaming with the loser in the cruise control. Babies in Reno with the vitamin D. Got a couple of couches, sleep on the love seat. Someone came saying I'm insane to complain about a shotgun wedding and a stain on my shirt. Don't believe everything that you breathe. They get a parking violation and a
A bizarre but catchy melange of hip-hop, blues, and strange samples, Loser featured Beck mumbling strange stream-of-consciousness lyrics and summing up the slacker ethos of the time by singing,
"So I won't get it all. I'm a loser, baby. So why don't you kill me? So I won't get it all. I'm a loser, baby. So why don't you kill me? Forces of evil and a bozo nightmare. Ban all the music with a phony gas chamber."
The single found its way onto LA flagship public radio station KCRW, where it was soon played to death, and then picked up by other college stations across the country. A couple of months later, Beck had a dozen record companies beating on his door. Less a case of playing hard to get than just wanting everybody to go away, Beck's reluctance to sign made the deals get sweeter and sweeter. Finally, he signed with Geffen, with an apparent provision that allowed him to release some of his more off-the-wall stuff on minor local labels. He went into the studio and recorded songs for his major label debut, Mellow Gold. And frankly, that should have been the end of it. Mellow Gold, despite the inclusion of Loser, is a pretty pedestrian affair, and though it briefly charted, it did not really make that much of a splash. This was about the time I was in Japan, and I couldn't believe that anybody had ever even heard of him over there, never mind become a rabid fan, ready to swim the mighty Pacific in order to bear his children. Then his second major release, Odelay, came out, and all hell broke loose.
Something's wrong, cause my mind is spinning. And everywhere I look, there's a dead end waiting. Temperatures dropping at the rotten oasis. Stealing kisses from the leprous faces.
Odelay gleefully delivered on the promise of Loser by cramming hip-hop and country and funk and blues and banjo and lounge and early analog synthesis and any and everything else into a blender and liquefying it into delicious post-postmodern sonic goo.
Got a devil's haircut in my mind. Got a devil's haircut in my mind. Got a devil's haircut. In my mind, got a devil's haircut. In my mind.
An extreme example of the supposed short attention span of Generation MTV.
MTV makes me wanna smoke crack.
Beck combines influences and fashion so quickly and so fluidly that a new hybrid culture emerges from the grooves of this phenomenal album. It is the sound of the global gumbo, the internet made audible, the compression of the entire 20th century into a few funky minutes. When Spin magazine caught up to him on his tour bus and told him that Odelay had been voted Album of the Year, he shrugged and replied, "Of course. What was the competition?" One of the most amazing things about Beck is that he's as popular as he is. His music is exhilaratingly experimental, his persona is anything but polished, and he lurches around on stage using dance moves that died 20 years ago, and yet people eat him up. I'm all for it, mind you, but it's an odd phenomenon. It's sort of like the ultimate revenge of the nerds, and it's nice to finally have a real dork for a pop star.
Streets the reek of tropical charms, the embassies lying hideous yards where tourists gnaw in decay. And when they dance in a reptile blaze, you wear a mask, an equatorial haze into the past, a colonial maze where there's no more confetti to throw.
You wouldn't know what to say to yourself. Love is a poverty you couldn't sell. Misery waits in big hotels. Be a victim.
After the success of Odelay, Geffen pushed out the more acoustic and mellow Mutations album, apparently without Beck's blessing. It was originally slated to go out on a small local label, like his One Foot in the Grave and Stereopathic Soul Manure had.
You wouldn't know what to say to yourself. Love is a poverty you couldn't sell. Misery waits in big hotels. Be loved with them.
The album is very restrained and quite pleasant, but nothing like the cultural smorgasbord of Odelay. Then Midnight Vulture's hit, returning to the familiar sonic slicing and dicing of his most popular album.
I'll be a chauffeur on a midnight drive. It takes a miracle just to survive.
This track is as good an example as anything from that album, and showcases his hilarious and peculiar lyrical style, in which what he says almost makes sense, but not quite.
I think we're going crazy. Her left eye is lazy. She looks so Israeli. Nicotine and gravy.
This track also breaks into a wonderful counterpoint section halfway through, in which several vocal lines are effortlessly woven together to great effect. Beck also has an incredible falsetto, which he showcases on the last track on this album. A hilarious ode to a cashier at JCPenney, Deborah features some of the sweetest soul to ever drip from a honky, and regularly brings the house down.
I met you at JCPenney. I think your name tag, I said Jenny. I co-stepped to you with a fish pack of gum. And somehow I knew you were looking for some. Oh no, like a fruit. That's right for the picking. I wouldn't do you like that. Sank a chicken. Cause only you got a thing that I just got to get with. I just got to get with you. And you know what we're gonna do. I wanna get with you.
Just about the time he was getting pigeonholed again, he released Sea Change, an album with remarkable airiness and restraint. Stripped down to their bare essentials and given a slow-mo production treatment that makes the music sound like it's moving through honey. Subtle and polished, Sea Change is a wonderful album, although it can take a little while to get your ears around it if you're expecting the blenderized, ironic, over-ornamented Pop-Tarts he made his name on. But Sea Change came from a different place. Inspired by the breakup of a 9-year relationship, Beck stripped all pretense, gimmickry, and flash out of the music, and was left with a handful of gorgeous, sometimes flinchingly honest songs that, together, chart an arc from heartbreak to hope. Is it the beginning of a new Beck, a more mature and sincere artist, or is it just another costume to try on in public? Only time and his next release will tell. For all his wonderful qualities, I do have one minor gripe with Beck, and I wouldn't even mention it if he hadn't done it twice. Unlike records, CDs are invisible while they're playing. And that, coupled with their impressive length, makes them the ideal format for burying hidden tracks. The vinyl album is limited to 20 minutes or so aside, so a track isn't going to stay hidden for that long. However, on a CD, you can stick 15 minutes of silence on the end of your last track and then sneak in a bonus cut. Many people have done this. It even shows up on Nirvana's Nevermind album. And I must say, it's gotten really old. Because what inevitably happens is that you put a few discs in the CD player, hit random, and then suddenly notice at some point that there's no more music. Many minutes go by before some incredibly awful sound comes out of your speakers. Apparently, by law, hidden CD tracks have to be really bad. Plus, when you first stick your shiny new CD into the player, you think, oh, cool, it's 75 minutes long, little realizing that there's actually 25 minutes of silence at the almost end. And like I say, I wouldn't even mention it, but Beck did it on both Odelay and Midnight Vultures. Lame, dude. Really, really lame.